Hare Krishna. Welcome. Manu Das asked me to speak today, and the subject I picked is Embrace the Journey. Embrace the Journey. What journey? We're always on a journey. When are we not on a journey? Life is a journey. Growing up, maturing, reaching adulthood, that's a journey. Going through the educational system, depending how high you go, that's a journey. And there are journeys within journeys. And when you're a little kid, what do you often say? What do kids say in the back seat of the car?
Where are we now?
Are we there yet?
Yeah.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Is that an example of embracing the journey?
Mm-hmm.
No. No. Or as they like to say in the Mayavadi circles, also true, be here now. Embrace the journey. Be present. If you're stuck in the past, if you regret the past and you think about the past, oh my God, wish you would have done that. Oh, I wish you wouldn't have done that. See, that was a mistake. Oh, that was embarrassing. That's a waste of time. You look at it, call it what it is, admit to yourself what it is, tell yourself the truth. Did you make a mistake? I made a mistake. Okay, it's all right. You're human. You're allowed a couple or more mistakes. Say what it is, say the truth, and then move on. Don't spend your time on it. Somebody said to me the other day, in relation to somebody else, she sure likes picking scabs off of old wounds. Never thought about it like that before. And I thought, yeah, that's a terrible thing to do. Just let's see if it's healed or not. No, let it go. Just let it go. When Prabhupada was here, Prabhupada is our founder, Acharya A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. I think he's... Where's his nearest picture? I can't... It's up in the corner there. Or on the wall there. There he is. On that wall. I can't see him. Sometimes devotees who are trying our best to serve, we make mistakes. We do silly things, stupid things. Sometimes Prabhupada would get angry and chastise somebody. And then a few minutes later, let it go. It would be gone. For Prabhupada, it would be gone. It would never be, the point would never be raised again, ever. Ever. And when he got real angry, I mean real angry, like when somebody got in a car accident and Prabhupada was in the car, so he'd get pretty angry sometimes. Then he wouldn't speak. He couldn't speak. It's too much. He'd say nothing. That's when you knew he was, you know, angry. But the point being, once he expressed how he felt about something, he didn't bring it up ever again. Just let it go. Didn't dwell on the past. And didn't worry about the future. If you regret the past and you worry about the future, then where are you? You're either in the past or you're in the future. You're not here. You're not in the present. Where does your power lie? In your journey, where does the power lie? In the past? You can say the power lies in the future because my potential is out there in the future yet to be realized. Reasonable statement. It's not unreasonable. But you can't get to the future, or you cannot manifest that future unless you are where? Right here, right now. For example, if I say something of any value today, hopefully I'll say something of some value to you, but you're not actually listening to me, you're actually worried about the past, regretting the past, or you're thinking about the future, you're not getting any benefit because you're not present. So, therefore, it's really important to embrace the journey, to be conscious of your journey. I wrote this down. We must learn to embrace the entire journey, not just this lifetime, which ends in death. We must learn in this lifetime not to fear death, but we must learn to welcome or embrace death. Since why? Since it is the doorway to the next phase of the journey. Do you ever take a child to school, first day of school? I have. And sometimes, you know, they're quite keen, they're quite eager to go, but oftentimes, I don't want to go, no, don't make me go. And you're at the door, you open the door, they won't go in. Or they go in, they run back out, you know. Why? New adventure, it's exciting. It's completely unfamiliar to them. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. I don't know the ropes. I don't know who I'm going to meet. I don't know what's expected of me. I'd rather be in my room at home playing with my toys. I got all that covered. It can be scary. Death is similar. You're letting go of something with which you are familiar, the world around you, I assume, at that point in time. Family, home, or wherever you may be, so many familiar things. And everything's going to change like that. That's scary. It's the unknown. But how will you continue with the adventure? How will you go on to the next thing? How will you learn? How will you grow? How will you evolve? If you're not willing to go on, or you're too afraid. What will the next phase bring after death? Well, it'll bring either another lifetime that brings other opportunities to learn important life lessons and fulfill more of your material desires. Why are we here on this planet in this lifetime? Two reasons primarily for humans. To fulfill desires. I don't have to coach you on that one. Everybody knows what that is. And to learn lessons. Pretty much. We learn lessons, we improve our karma. We have this little blessing that God has given us, and that's called free will. And with free will, we are free to learn lessons. If we learn lessons, we improve karma, which means we don't continue to make the same mistakes over and over again. That's a blessing. Or you can use your free will and not learn anything if you choose, and continue to make the same mistakes over again. Like step in mud puddles one after another, or constantly touch the candle flame with your finger whenever you can so that you get burned. Those are silly examples, but we do this in so many ways. One of the common ones I hear, because I do counseling and consultations with people, thousands of them actually, is a woman's in relationship with a man, and of course they're hoping the relationship will blossom and develop and get better over time. And her girlfriends, who know her best, either behind her back or to her face, are going, "Oh my God, what is she doing? This is not going to work. Why is she with this guy?" And, you know. And then finally, you know, maybe they've said something to her. Maybe you can't. Depends. And finally, the relationship breaks up, breaks off. And her girlfriend's going, "Whew. Okay, good, you know. Dodged a bullet." And then, you know, 6 months down the road, a year down the road, she's in another relationship. Same guy. No, I mean, same guy? No, different guy. Same guy. Different face, different body, different name. But same dynamic between the two people. Too many similarities, like the relationship before. You ever heard that? You ever seen it? Have you ever lived it? You know? Why would she do that? Did she do that consciously? Not likely. Did she do that unconsciously? Highly likely. Why? Because unconsciously, she is drawing to herself exactly the type of person she needs to do what? To marry? No. Well, she might marry him. Happens all the time. To learn a lesson. This person, whether you like him or don't like him, it doesn't matter. It's not the point. He's there carrying the lessons, carrying the possibility of her lesson being learned. That's why he's there. We don't really appreciate that for the most part. And the best thing that could happen is simply she learns the lesson. And what would that mean? Well, then that means that lesson's learned and she won't attract the same person again, theoretically. Sometimes people wonder, I speak to many women, well, men too, but, you know, most people, they don't say, "Well, for my first marriage, I'm going to marry Tom." Who talks like that? No one. One marriage. Everybody wants one marriage. That's how we think. It doesn't matter what culture you're from. You know, generally, we want one marriage. Let's get that one done and leave it at that. We don't say, "Well, for my second marriage, you know, I got John lined up." No. So we hope to learn the lessons and get married. But if we don't learn the lesson, in the West, maybe not in India, but in the West, people date. They have different partners or girlfriends or boyfriends, and the relationships go on for a while. That's what we do here. We're taught this from childhood, are we not? This is our culture. This is what we learn. So it's what we do. So we want to learn those lessons as quickly as possible. But if we don't, and we have different relationships with different people, one thing we should be able to see is progress. And I just ask my clients, I say, "Well, okay, so you were this gentleman for 2 years, this, that. Now you're in a new relationship with this person. Is it an improvement over the last one? Is it better? Are you more fulfilled? Is it meeting more of your needs and fulfilling more of your desires? And she says, yes. Great. Progress. That's not the Vedic system. In the Vedic system, which you try to follow as much as possible here in Krishna consciousness, is to find compatibility between two people, which traditionally is done astrologically through Vedic astrology. It eliminates a lot of difficulties, potential difficulties. But I'm talking about the real world that we're living in here, or the illusory real world that we live in here. So, if you still have material desires when you die, what are material desires? Desires connected to matter. We've got spirit, we've got matter. Material world, physicality, temporality, it's temporary. So if we, at the point of death, if we have material desires connected to the body, loved ones, objects, things, activities connected to the earth, to the material energy, then we will be back. We'll get another body to take another birth. Why? To fulfill your desires. You have them. That's another example of the grace of God. Yeah, but I'm really attached to doing this, and I haven't done it yet. Okay, no problem. You can come back. We'll fix you up with another body. No problem. As many bodies as you need, you can get. No limit. So, if you get off the wheel of repeated birth and death, which is called samsara in Sanskrit, then you go to the spiritual world, you become a liberated soul. And you don't have to take another birth because you are no longer materially conditioned. Brahmabhuta prasannatma na shochati na kankshati sama sarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate para. This is from the Bhagavad Gita, 18th chapter, 54th verse, where Krishna is explaining to Arjuna what it means to be a realized soul. As I think most of you know, the Bhagavad Gita is a sacred conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. Krishna is God. God manifests in many forms. Krishna is considered to be the original form. Adidevam ajam vibhum. And Krishna also appeared as an avatar 5,000 years ago down on earth. And that's when the conversation took place between Krishna and Arjuna. Arjuna was a prince or warrior. Kshatriya. Kshatriya means a social level. And it refers to that social level, that group of persons whose job it is to protect everybody else. To govern, to protect, to look after, to organize, to administrate on behalf of everybody else. So that's what Arjuna was. And Arjuna was coincidentally also Krishna's cousin. Most importantly, his friend. So, Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma. When one is on the Bhuta, on the platform of Brahma, what does Brahma mean? One word. Give it to me, please.
Spirit.
Spirit. Correct. Brahma means spirit. When you are on, truly on the spiritual platform, Which means what? It means you actually realize you're a soul. And you're connected to being a soul. Yeah, do you have a body? Oh, yeah, yeah. You can have a body. We have bodies. Do we have to wait till we die before we can reach the spiritual platform in terms of our consciousness and awareness? No. We don't. We can have that now. While we're still alive. So, Krishna is explaining, these are the symptoms of a person who is Brahma Bhuta, who has reached the spiritual platform. Prasannatma. Prasanna Atma. His Atma, what's the Atma? Soul or self. His Atma is Prasanna, fully joyful, fully satisfied. Why? Because he's going out to buy a new car? No. Just cause. In his state of being, in his state of mind, that fulfills everything. Well, could he buy a new car if he wanted one? Yes, he could. That's not the point. He's fully satisfied. Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma na shochati na kangshati. Shochati means? Na means not, obviously. He does not lament. Oh, poor me. Oh, this happened. Oh, I'm fretting about the past. I'm worrying about the future. Na shochati. He said, let all that go. I gave you an example of Prabhupada earlier. He doesn't keep lamenting over it. You know, if only they would change this government. If only, if only. Sounds like me. Nakangshti, he does not desire. Nor does he desire. Because his desires are satisfied. He's fulfilled. Nashochati, Nakangshti. Nakangshti. Now this one, particularly, they're all difficult. I'm just going to be straightforward with you. All of them are difficult. None of them are easy. Sama sarveshu bhuteshu, among sarva bhuta, among all living beings. All living beings. Humans? No. Bhuta means everybody. Sama. He is sama. What does sama mean? Equal. He's equal. Treats everybody the same. Everybody, yeah, everybody. He gives respect to whom? Everybody. Doesn't matter what the station of life is. It doesn't matter. It's not important. Why? There's differences, you know, in the material world and society. Yes, there are. But not in the spiritual realm. Not when you recognize the soul. There are no differences. The soul is part of God. It's divine spark. Well, you could argue, yeah, but different spiritual people have different degrees of consciousness. That's true. But it's still a soul. That's why, you know, we here in Krishna consciousness, we bow down regularly. Both hands, both knees. And some people who come here for the first time, what's he doing? Why is he going down on his hands and knees? Oh my God, they don't want me to do that. In fact, they won't even ask you to do that. Either you will or you won't do it. It's up to you. Why? Because first of all, if we're in the temple, we're recognizing the presence of God. Number one. But devotees will also bow down to each other, not in the temple, in front of the deity, but outside the temple room itself, they will bow down to each other. Why will they do that? Because again, they're recognizing the soul within the other person's body. You're bowing down to the soul. You might say, I don't even like that guy. You know, I really care for him. Still bow down. How? How will you bow down? You're bowing down to the spiritual spark within him. Sama sarveshu bhuteshu is equal to all living beings. Oh, well, that's going to be real hard for me to do because I'm going to have to swallow my pride, swallow my ego. Yeah, there you go. And practice humility. That's real hard sometimes. Yeah. I'll tell you, there's nothing that will bring you closer to God faster than the practice of humility. Trying to make yourself humble. In other words, pulling the rug out from under your own ego. Have you ever done that in different ways in your life? Undermine your ego? Oh my God, he freaks out. He gets real angry very quickly. Why do I say he? Because the ego's male. Oh yeah. Even in women? Oh yeah. Ego is male. Soul is feminine. Gentle. Humble. Submissive. Accommodating. Loving. Understanding, nurturing. Those are nice qualities. Aren't those feminine qualities by nature? Well, men can have them. Yeah, we hope. We hope they do. But they're feminine. They come to women far more easily. That's why, generally speaking, women's egos are not as strong or as dominant as that of men. You can argue with me about that till the cows come home, but I won't believe you. It's true. So the ego is like, I like to compare the ego to a dog in charge of his territory. You know, when you walk by somebody's house or their yard and the dog starts barking at you from behind the fence and it bares its teeth, and you must be public enemy number one. In this dog's mind, all you're doing is walking past. And some of them are vicious. You can't think, good thing there's a fence there. That's the ego when his territory is threatened. It's not very different. Why? Because if the ego loses his territory, if he gets replaced, he's done. He's finished. What replaces him? The self, the Atma, the soul. And he will die. Hopefully, we like the ego to die a quick death, but that's pretty rare. You know, ego just goes, hook me up to the machines. I'm not going anywhere. Yeah, but you're brain dead. That's okay. Hook me up. I'm staying. I'm breathing the air. Slow death. Slow death. You work on it a whole lifetime. It's not easy. It's not easy. So, what's the rest of the verse? There's only one more line. Mad bhaktim labhate param. Mad bhaktim labhate param. In that state of mind, when you're fully self-satisfied, prasannatma, brahma-buddha, you're totally or completely or truly in touch with spirit, you don't nashochati, you don't lament, excuse me, nakankshati, you don't desire, and you're equal to everyone. All humans, all animals. At that time, you labhate, he achieves mad bhaktim, devotion to me. Here in Krishna consciousness, our goal or our focus, unlike most spiritual paths and most systems of yoga, is not simply moksha or liberation from repeated birth and death. Why? You don't think that's a good thing? No, I think that's a great thing, personally. But there's something higher than that. And in most systems of yoga and Eastern spirituality, it's not really discussed. It's not really even thought about in a lot of them. And that's a loving relationship with God. A loving relationship with the Creator, with the Supreme Being. Personal relationship, like persons, eternally. That's our focus here. So Krishna says, these are his words, mad bhaktim. Mad to me, bhaktim, bhakti means bhakti yoga, devotion. He attains love and devotion for me, param, supreme. Param means supreme, the best, the topmost. The topmost destination is mad bhaktim param, devotion to me. That's what happens. Now, let's go back to our journey here. We're on the journey. Which journey do you want to be on? Or shall we say, what is your orientation for your journey? Let's divide that into three, because it works pretty good. We have a physical or bodily orientation down here on earth. And generally, that falls into two categories. What are they? Number one, gender. You're either male or a female. Pretty much. I haven't seen a lot of neuter people walking around. You're either male or female. Right? And what's the second one? Racial. Look at us all here in this room. There are a lot of races here. A lot of people, different countries, different races, different nationalities, different ethnic persuasions. And here we all sit peacefully, hopefully enjoying each other's company and sharing satsang. That's what we're doing here. Sharing a spiritual atmosphere, spiritual communion. Now, as we know, most of the problems on the face of the earth come about because of bodily identification. More often than not, they're racial. And if they're racial, they're nationalistic. So, you know, each country has its own flag. It creates a lot of problems. You know. Yes, my friend. Can you see me now? You can come a bit closer. You got a couple more inches to spare there. So, national. Or, we're different colors. And we have different features because of our racial differences. How many wars have they fought over this stuff? Historically. Who can count? This goes on and on. And then if you have, you know, religious leanings, we won't get into all that. And what about the, as they've, at least in the West here, they've said for years, the war between the sexes. And that's, isn't that how they say it? The war between the sexes. Is there a war? Did I miss something? When did they go to war, the sexes? Gender superiority. We'll fix those men. In fairness, men haven't behaved very well for a lot of years. There's all kinds of examples of that. And they, because they're driven by ego, that's why. If they were driven by spirit, I wouldn't be saying that. Men are meant to protect women. not exploit them. That's the Vedic system. Not taking advantage of them, not using them, not lying to them, not tricking them. No. So after a lot of years of that, in general, speaking generally, women created an uprising with the suffragettes and said, we want women's liberation, women's rights, we want equality, we want to get paid the same amount of money, we're going into the workplace and you better look out. Well, I think that's reasonable. I don't think that was unreasonable. It seems like a reasonable reaction to what happened. Now you'll see on TV, if you watch television commercials, that the stupid one in the family is always the man now. And the woman's always solving the problem. Yeah, no. Here, give me that. Let me do that. You know. So men are portrayed as not very bright and not very capable, as rather inept. That's the latest thing. So the tables have turned. Well, is that true about men? Well, it can be, but I wouldn't say that's a fair, it's a fair general truth. No. But that's what they get for doing all the stuff they did. Okay. All right. So whenever there's a conflict, it's going to go to one extreme. We'd like it to go back to the middle where we'll find balance between the two sides, between the two extremes, between the two polarities. But it never goes like that, does it? It goes like this, all the way over there to that side. We get one extreme, and then we go to the other extreme. And then, if we're lucky, we'll find the balance at some point in time. We haven't done that yet with gender, I don't think. But that's okay. It's a work in progress. The more you're identified with your gender and with your nationality, the less you are identified with what you really are, which is a spiritual being. Some people will fight the good fight throughout their lifetimes, and they'll protest, and they'll start, you know, one thing or another to overthrow a certain law or a certain point of view in society. I'm not criticizing them. They're too wrapped up. Years ago, when I was living in the ashram, a black devotee came and he joined the temple. But this was, he was educated in Yale University. He was a very intelligent man and a very thoughtful man. And he came and he joined the ashram. But he had this, you know, a bit of a chip on his shoulder, and probably reasonably so, because we're in America. And, you know, black people were treated as less. There was racial discrimination. Still is. But even more so back then. And he got an audience with Prabhupada, a private audience. Even private means there were a few people there. But so Prabhupada was very kind and very encouraging. And, you know, thank you for coming. Thank you for joining. Thank you for, joining with us and taking up spiritual life seriously. Prabhupada would always thank. Always thank somebody who came to serve and to give up their material life in some way. He was always very grateful for that. Should he be grateful? Well, I don't know if he should or shouldn't, but he always was. This devotee's name is Ghanashyam. I believe he became a sannyasi a little bit later on. I don't remember what his name was. I don't know if he's still alive at this stage. Do you know? Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj he became. Is he still alive? 2005, he left the planet. So he said, he had this audience with Prabhupada, and at some stage during the audience, he says, I've been staying in the ashram. Your devotees still discriminate against black people. Prabhupada said, huh? All of them? No. Just a few. They discriminate against blacks. And Prabhupada said, well, maybe once you let that go in your own mind, it'll stop. Oh. Never dawned on him. As long as he held on to that, it came to him. He drew it to himself. His belief system attracted to him what he thought or he expected society to be. So it came. So Prabhupada says, yeah, as soon as you let that go, no problem. That won't be an issue anymore in your life. Oh, is it an issue? Oh, yeah, it's an issue in society. But it doesn't have to be an issue in your life. And you take people as they come. I have a lot of black friends throughout my lifetime. I wasn't raised with any black people. The first time I ever saw a black person on the streets in Canada where I was raised, I stopped walking and turned and looked across the street and watched the man walk down the street. I'd never seen a black man before. Oh my God, there's a black person there. I saw him on TV, but I never... Yeah. I have a lot of black friends. Is it an issue if they're black? It's only an issue if it's an issue to them. It's never been an issue to me. It's a person. You have a relationship with a person. So, you can go on the journey with the body. The body's what? It's your vehicle. It's just your vehicle. Don't put all your energy into the vehicle. Don't throw all your identity into your vehicle. Don't get so caught up in the vehicle. Somebody buys a new car. Oh my God, I think there's a scratch here. Oh my God, do you have a cloth? Eh? You seen that? In the parking spots in Ireland here, they're about this wide. So I don't know, you won't get a scratch. It's just a car. It's a vehicle. It's a body. Okay, now there's two more levels. Inside the vehicle, we got the passenger and we got the driver. Yep. I'm not using that analogy that there's a picture in the Bhagavad Gita. I'm using a different analogy here for those of you who are, your minds are going to that. We have the body, we have the individuality, and we have the soul. Okay? What's the individuality? That's the ego. Right now, you have an individuality. It's, and part of that is your personality, what you like, your abilities, your talents, your interests. You're an individual. Anybody who knows you, your friends can sit down and talk about you and say all these things that they all know, and they all know because, and then she does this and she says that, and then we laugh. Oh yeah, well you know her really well then, don't you? Yes, I know her. You know. Individuality. That individuality is only there for this lifetime, like that body. The body, the vehicle, is only there for this lifetime. The individuality that you possess in this lifetime is only there for this lifetime. And in your next lifetime, it won't be the same. You may have some qualities and interests that you had in last life, and likely you will. But you will not have the same individuality, particularly if you shift gender. Once you change vehicle, correct? So what's more important, do you think? The gender or the individuality? Clearly, the individuality. That's why some women have a problem in relationship. Why? Because the man is looking at the gender. Oh, she looks great. Look at that. Look at that body. Female body parts. She's got all the parts. Men like that. Oh yeah, they do. Is that what she is? She's just female and body parts and those things? Yeah. But she's an individual. She's a person. She's a personality. She's got aspirations. She wants to fulfill herself as a person. You can't just see her as a body. You have to recognize her individuality, her personhood. Or you're not seeing her. You're seeing this much of her. You know people like this. That's all they see. Just the body. So you have to recognize that person within. Okay, so this body, this vehicle, this individuality, this person, I call it the passenger, is on the journey of what? Together, one lifetime only. That's the one we have right now. Only one. What about next lifetime? You change bodies and you change individuality. What remains the same? Number three, the third part, the soul. What journey is the soul on? The entire journey. All lifetimes. All individualities, all bodies, all forms. Don't forget, we take animal forms, insect forms, plant forms also before we get to the human form. The soul is there. What's eternal? The soul is eternal. Not the ego, not the individuality, not the gender. So where do you want to place your consciousness and your focus? Where? You have a choice. Don't forget, free will. Hey, I got a choice. Doesn't mean you shouldn't look nice and dress nicely and put yourself together and look good at work. No, no. That's good. It's not bad. You should look good. You should look attractive. Goddess Fortune loves it when you look really good. Lakshmiji loves it. When your house is in order, it's nicely decorated, it's clean, the larder is full of food. Lakshmi loves it. Right, Shifra? And yeah, you should present yourself nicely, no question. We don't neglect the body. We don't neglect the health, hopefully. But the soul. The soul is ultimately the driver. And as we know from the Katha Upanishad, there's the soul within the body and who else? Atma and Paramatma, super soul. God within the heart. How do they explain it? So beautifully. It's like two birds on the same tree. The tree, in this case, is the body and the individuality. One bird is eating of the fruits of the tree, just as we eat the fruits of what's to be had in the material world. Oh, we're going to try this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to take this course, and let's go out to dinner at such and such a place, and, you know, I got a new boyfriend, or I got married, and life is great. We're eating the fruits that are on offer here in the material world. That's what the soul does. You're free to eat fruits as much as you want. Try not to overeat. And the super soul, or God in the heart, who is the second bird, is simply sitting there on the tree next to the soul, next to you. What's he doing? He's the sakshi. You know what a sakshi is? It's a witness. He's the witness. You think you're going to get away with something? Good luck on that one, because God is there in your heart. There are many witnesses mentioned in the Vedas, and one of them is the sun. So if you think that once the sun goes behind the cloud, you can do some stuff, you don't get away with it, that you shouldn't be doing, no. God is still there in the heart. So he's the witness. Does he interfere? No. No. He waits. He has infinite patience. Infinite. What's he waiting for? He's waiting for you to see him. He's waiting for you to actually recognize there he is.
Well, what are you doing here?
I've been here all along. I didn't see you. I know. You've been too busy eating the fruits of life, enjoyment of life. You've been distracted on the journey. Have you ever had that experience? I know a few people at this stage of my life that, you know, it happened to me once where they just said to me in meditation, they said, look what it took for us to get you here. Look what it took. Look what we had to do. Turn your life upside down and pull it apart so we could get your attention. That's how I reacted. Oh my God. I spoke to this woman on the phone the other day in Los Angeles. And her boyfriend is a good friend of mine, a client of mine that I've known for 20 years. And they're in L.A. and they had met recently. And he said to her, let's go over to the Krishna Center. She said, what? He says, let's go over to the Krishna Center. A Krishna Center? Those guys who jump up and down on the ropes, in the ropes with the ponytail, making the noise, asking for a donation. You want to go there? Why on earth would you want to go there? He says, well, have you been there? No. He said, well, it's really, really nice there. They have this beautiful temple. Beautiful. Transcendental. And they have this bookstore, this gift store. Wonderful, wonderful things in there. And they have a restaurant. And they serve the best vegetarian food. That's what he told her. Come on. Let's go. Okay. You know. So they go. First place to go is into the temple. Like during the day, which means there's nobody in there. It's, you know, it's quiet. It's quiet. It's peaceful. Sometimes it's very busy, like here now. They go into the temple and she stands in front of the deity of Radha and Krishna. And she takes one look at those deities. They're marble deities. Krishna is black. Radha is white marble. And they're dressed very, very beautifully. And the altar is, wonderfully designed. There's marble, there's rosewood. I couldn't even describe it to you. It's the beauty of the altar, all fresh flowers everywhere. And the smell of incense, and it's, you know, it's a really beautiful place. It transports you like it's meant to. She walks in and she stands in front of Radha and Krishna on the altar, and within minutes she's on her knees crying. Within minutes. Excuse me? Sit still. Be quiet. Thank you. In no time, she's on her knees and she's crying. Because that's the effect it had on her. And since then, she's been a devotee of Krishna. How did that happen? Did somebody explain the philosophy to her? Did she read the Bhagavad Gita? No, no, and no. None of those things. Why? Because she turned her head and saw the other bird on the tree. What prompted her to do that? Her friend said, come on, let's go to the Krishna Center. That's what prompted her to do it. She wouldn't have gone there in a million years, so to speak. And that's what happened upon seeing the deity once. Why? Because it was time. It was time for her to begin her spiritual life. And whatever she had done up to that point in time, it now had borne fruit, the spiritual fruit of her awakening and of Krishna recognizing her and calling her back to him. Otherwise, she wouldn't be in tears on her knees. She says, what the heck was I doing on my knees? I said, what were you doing on your knees? She said, I couldn't stand. Couldn't stand up. When it's time, it's time. Now I'm going to read something from just a short passage from Greek literature about Athena and Perseus. As you know, there we can read the hero's journey in many places. Certainly in the Vedas, there's many examples of stories in Srimad Bhagavatam, etc., of the hero's journey, what the hero is required to do, to overcome, to reach the goal. And in the Vedas, it's mostly a spiritual goal. Not always, but mostly. Here, Athena is the goddess of wisdom and the patron of the arts in the Greek pantheon, as Saraswati would be in the Vedic pantheon, as Minerva would be in the Roman. Okay? Perseus is a 15-year-old boy who doesn't know where he comes from, does not know his origins. Right? In the Greek legend of Perseus, Perseus and his mother Danae are banished from their home while Perseus is still a baby. When he's 15, living in a foreign land, the goddess Athena appears to him. She appears much taller than any mortal man and exceedingly beautiful. No matter how beautiful people are here, down here on earth, and there are many, many beautiful people. We know that. Male and female alike. When you go up to the heavenly planets where the gods live, the demigods, the goddesses, the angels, the archangels, if you like, this ain't nothing compared to the beauty that you'll find there. When you go to the spiritual world, yet on another level. It's a different place. So anyway, she's very beautiful. Perseus is overwhelmed by the sight of her, I guess so. She's probably 10 foot tall, 12 feet tall. They say that the gods and the goddesses are much, much taller than us. She seems to know all the secrets of his soul. Isn't that just wonderful when you meet somebody that seems to know the secrets of your soul? What is that worth? She asks him to choose a path in life. So this is for you. She asks him to choose a path in life. She says, I am Athena and I know the thoughts of all men's hearts. I can discern whether they are enlightened or asleep, conscious or unconscious. From the souls of clay, I turn away. From the souls of clay, I turn away. They fatten at their ease like sheep in the pasture and eat what they did not sow like oxen in a stall. They grow and spread like the gourd along the ground, but like the gourd, they give no shade to the traveler. And when they are ripe, death gathers them and they go down unappreciated and unloved. Who's she talking about? She's talking about people who are self-interested. that are not working toward the benefit of humanity, are not trying to help make the world a better place. I'm not making any judgments here, but generally humans, more or less self-interested. So they go down, death gathers them, and they are unappreciated and unloved, and their name vanishes out of the land. They are not remembered. But to the souls of fire, souls of clay, souls of fire, she calls them here. But to the souls of fire, I give more fire. And to those who are enlightened, I bestow gifts and blessings beyond that of humans. These are the heroes, the sons, the daughters of the immortals, who are blessed, unlike the souls of clay. I drive them forth by strange paths. Have you ever been driven forth in your life on strange paths? I know I am. Perseus, that they may fight the demons and the monsters, the enemies of the gods and men. Through doubt and need, danger and battle, I drive them. Some of them are slain in the flower of youth, no man knows where or when. Some of them win noble names in a fair and ripe old age. But what will be their final end, even I do not know. No one knows except Zeus. Zeus is God. It's Krishna, the father of gods and men. Tell me now, Perseus, which of these two sorts of men seem to you to be more blessed? The souls of clay or the souls of fire? That's our choice. Do we want to remain unconscious? Or do we want to become conscious? Here, we want to become conscious. That's why we're here together. And that's why we chant Harinam, the holy names of God, because it is the Yuga Dharma. It is the recommended practice in the age that we are currently living in. And anyone can do it. Even a child. So embrace the journey, all parts of it, stay present, and daily, all day long, give thanks. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Questions? Disagreements? Corrections? Comments? Manu.
You very nicely explained how, you know, we're here to fulfill the desires or to get correction and so on. And a lot of the time, some of the desires, and when we become conscious, our desires we know we shouldn't, or they're not good desires to have, even though we're afflicted by them. What sort of attitude should we have to unwanted desires?
We all have unwanted desires. Oh God, I wish I wouldn't do that. Oh geez, I did that again. I promised myself I wouldn't do it. Here I am eating the entire tub of ice cream. I cannot believe it. And that's not the first time. We want to change things, and that's why we encourage people here and are encouraged to practice spiritual practices like chanting and reading Shravanam, Kirtanam, reading the books, spending time with people who are on the same path, a similar path. You will fall down. Most people will fall down, meaning most people will get tripped up and fall into old conditioned patterns of behavior. And I'm not going to look you in the eyes and tell you different, because it wouldn't be true. Especially in Kali Yuga, the Iron Age, it's very, very difficult to find people who can make a vow and stick with the vow and say, this is it, I'm doing this for the rest of my life, and that's all there's to it. And then we get overwhelmed. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, even the mind of a person of intelligence will get carried away by material desire. Material desire is very powerful. If you are carried away by material desire, you have to let it go. That's all. I mean, don't beat yourself up. Don't torment yourself. Don't keep criticizing yourself over and over again. Just over time, try to strengthen yourself spiritually through spiritual practice such as chanting. And, you know, here it says, one of the verses I included, Sahajam karma kanteya sadosham api na tyajet sarvarambha hidoshena dumenag agnir ivavritaha. Every endeavor in the material world is covered by some fault, some flaw, as fire is covered by smoke, as a mirror is covered by dust. There's no such thing as a perfect circumstance or action or situation in the material world. It does not exist. That's the definition of the material world. So that means, does that mean we don't try, we don't strive, we don't endeavor? No. We try and we strive as best as we can, and we don't give up just because it has a flaw or a fault or, oh my God, I didn't do it perfectly. It's okay. It's okay. For Krishna's part, and I know this about Krishna, I absolutely know it, Krishna does not care what you don't do. Krishna does not count your failures and your mistakes. He's not even remotely interested in that. He's only interested in your devotion, your love, and the things you do with him in mind. That's what he's interested in. So that's what we must focus on. And if you're, you know, constructive criticism is a good thing. We all know that. Destructive criticism is not good at all. When you criticize yourself to a point where, you know, you get disillusioned and depressed or defeated, what value does that have? You won't want to continue. You won't want to try again. And the same thing is if you criticize other people destructively until they won't want to do anything anymore, what's the point? I once said to a woman, I said, you don't cook? No, I don't cook. Oh, didn't your mother teach you to cook? Well, she tried to, but every time she did, she said, here, give me that. You're not doing it right. And she took the utensils out of my hand and, never mind, I'll do it. Did she learn how to cook? No. Is that a surprise? No. You have to bring people along. You have to bring yourself along. You know, not be hard on yourself. Does that answer that? Anyone else? Love. Ishwara.
In the picture is saying that we should be optimists rather than pessimists.
Yeah.
Because I always tell that in my book. I found that I couldn't get on well with people who were pessimistic.
No.
They didn't do what they were told to do. They wouldn't listen.
Yeah.
I tried to change them around to be an optimist.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you have to. We're conditioned. We're all conditioned from childhood and even before. other lifetimes, we're conditioned to certain kinds of behaviors and certain kinds of belief patterns. And some of them are just entrenched. They're like tattooed on your brain, on your behavior. It's not easy to let it go. Believe me. Sometimes it may take lifetimes to let things go. I don't want to discourage you, but you know, it takes a lot of lifetimes to become a realized soul. It does. It's a fact. Because we're so conditioned and we're so attracted, we're so drawn by this material energy, which is what? It's dead. It's inert. That's what we're attracted to. Dead, inert energy that falls apart sooner or later. That's the thing our minds are going, ooh, I like that. Yeah, looks good today. Wait 3 weeks, see, you know. If somebody puts a beautiful plate of food in front of you, and your favorite dish, oh my God, this is great, I love this. Yeah, just let it sit there 3 weeks and come back, tell me if you want to eat it. You don't. That's the nature of the material energy. If we focus on the spiritual energy, we are investing in our eternal future, in our eternal life, our eternal reality. But it takes effort. It's not easy. But it gets easy if you can do something as simple as chanting. It's quite easy. But we need purification, and that takes time. Okay, are you going to chant, Manu? Thank you. Thank you for your kind attention.